Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we meet the president of Peaceable Kingdom that makes cooperative games for kids.
And I think that's one of the most important things I've learned in my life, how to just keep your heart open to everybody.
And we revisit a Women in History profile. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Donna Jaffe's Peaceable Kingdom makes cooperative games for kids where players have to work together to win. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all just get along? Jaffe and her staff believe in a number of things, such as slowing down and putting screens aside so we can play with our kids, in spending time with friends and in connecting with family. Jaffe and her team also believe that doing this even for a little bit every day nourishes our spirit. KALW Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller brings us her conversation with Jaffe.
We need to talk about what's happening in our country.
Yes, we do.
We're in this situation where I would say most of the country is feeling pretty contentious, and that we have drawn, each of us, a line in the sand. We are at this face-off. No one's getting along with anyone that they don't agree with. From the standpoint where you come from, how do you get people working cooperatively? How would your games help this situation?
I'm in agreement. I'm not a particularly political person, and yet I'm overwhelmed by what's happening. And I feel like we're in the shadow of something that's completely negative for so many different people in our country. So do the games have the potential to actually help people come together, think differently about otherness? I don't know. What we've seen in the playing of the games is that, unlike a competitive game where people are really playing against one another, they're fighting for themselves, they're victorious and elated when they're working together as a team, all of those barriers sort of go away about the me in the situation, and it really does become the we. How are we together going to figure out how to win? Some of our games for the youngest children are not particularly strategic. But those for older kids, they really need to work together. They really need to come together, make decisions together, potentially even sacrifice their own move for the benefit of the team. So that's where I see there is the possibility. I'm not going to say that games in any way will change how people are in the world. But even if they could change slightly, if we could make a difference in how they relate to each other, that's really what we're going for.
Do you think there are certain characteristics of a person who is willing to play cooperatively versus one who is strictly committed to the competitive approach?
Absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. I think really strongly that there is a huge degree of competition within the game. So someone who is inherently more competitive than someone else will still be competing against the game. The game could win. That structure is built into all of our games. So you can be as competitive you want. You're just working as a team. That's the difference.
How do you think that applies to situations outside of playing the games?
Think about how often you cooperate, in your life. There's so many ways. Yeah, I think it's people who are figuring out how to collaborate, how to let go a little bit of what their intention is on a personal level and look at the greater good for the group.
I just was listening to something on the radio the other day about what it had to do with taxes, which has absolutely nothing to do with gaming. I get that. But taxes are in itself kind of a game, right? You know, working the system. But they said that if an MRI was placed on which I don't know that MRIs get placed on anyone's head, but if an MRI was placed on the head of a Republican that talking about the economic gains would light their brain up, and if it was placed on the head of a Democrat or a more liberal person, then talking about fairness would light their brain up.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about that? And you said you're not a political person, so this is just, you know, discussion.
I'm going to guess that for most people, Democrat or Republican, that parts of their brains are going to light up for different kinds of things. I mean, all of us to a degree or another have little bits of all kinds of qualities in us, right? So some are more cooperative, some are more competitive, some people are kinder, some people are more humble, some people less so. And that's just the nature of the world. So how do we encourage those qualities, those values that promote cooperation in the greater world? How do we do that from a young age so that the divisiveness of the country right now, the fear that's going on in the country, isn't as great? That's our goal. I mean, that in a lot of ways, that's what Peaceable Kingdom is trying to do. We're trying to help children learn what a more peaceable kingdom could look like and then make that happen in their world.
Do you, as you observe kids playing the games, as you're testing out new games or the games that you've already got, do you see any differences from a gender standpoint?
No, I really don't. That doesn't come into play at all. I think kids become engaged. If they're engaged in the story of the game, they're engaged in the game.
What are some examples of games that you've got out there right now?
Well, Hoot Owl Hoot, one of our games, probably one of our best-selling games, I guess I should say, is a great strategic game, even for the youngest players. And a lot of people, when they open the game and they look inside the box, parents might say, oh, this reminds me of Candyland in some way. In a lot of ways, it's the antithesis of Candyland. Candyland is a random game. You might be toward the end. You might be think you're winning, and then all of a sudden you're sent all the way back. And Candyland often ends in tears. Our games never end in tears. Nobody ever throws up the board. So in Hoot Owl Hoot, all the players are working together strategically, and the parents are super engaged as well because there's thinking that goes on in that game, and the strategy can be talked about because you're playing cooperatively. So the parent doesn't have to lose when they're playing with a young kid in order to make that kid feel good. They're all working together to figure it out.
What's the objective?
To move the owls around the board and into the nest before the sun rises. So all the little baby owls are out at night. Morning is coming, and you want to hurry up and get those owls home.
Oh,
so it's very simple. It's very straightforward. The kids are very compelled by the story, but the game is fairly straightforward when you look at it, just highly strategic. I was at an event, and we do events all of the time, and I was at an event a few years ago. There were people of all ages there, and some college kids were there, and they sat down to play Hoot Owl Hoot. And they lost the first time they played, which is pretty typical for our games. Players tend to lose the first time until they kind of get it and understand it, which is also great because it really encourages them for the next play. And these college kids sat down to play the game and they lost. And they hunkered down. They added more owls. They really said, what are we going to do here to win this game? So it was fun to see older people playing the game.
That's great. So there is still tension about whether or not you're going to make it.
There absolutely is. There's this feeling of urgency. So you really are playing against something that is externally in the game. You really can see that the potential for loss in the game.
So what of all the things to do in the world, why choose to run a game company?
I have always loved games since I was a little girl, and I played cards with my grandma and her friends, and I felt so grown up, and I felt part of a community. I felt listened to. I felt like my voice mattered in that little world, even as a little girl. I loved the idea of the puzzle. Not that I'm a particularly brainy person, but I like that in a game. I like being challenged and thinking about something. And the company, Peaceable Kingdom, we've been around since 2000. We made other children's products. But when we had the opportunity to move into games and we started playing these cooperative games, we realized that we fell in love with an idea that was not really out in the marketplace and that could alter the way people actually play games together, to have the competitive spirit in something that teaches cooperation. So it felt in a lot of ways like this was my sole work, I have to say, something I felt incredibly passionate about and wanted to do right.
Were you doing something else before you started the company?
I was actually in film for a short period of time. I've always loved the idea of story, I think. And so in film, you're telling a story. And I was a writer. I've been a writer. And in the games as well, there's a piece of story to the games, especially in a children's game, but not always in strategic adult games. There's a story and you move into another world and you are in that world for a short period of time. In a children's game, maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes. In an adult game, you can play for hours in another world. And I just love that.
And you have the narrative arc of the challenge and the choice that the heroine or hero has to make.
Yes,
and then
you
the
do.
Outcome.
Yes, you do.
Well, I understand that your dad was part of starting this company as well.
Yes, it's a family business, actually. And Peaceable is one of the divisions. Peaceable Kingdom is one of the divisions in the larger family business. And he also loves story. He was in the book business. He's still part of the company, as are both of my brothers. They're all based in St. Louis. And one of the divisions sells trade paperback books to the education market, to public schools around the U.S. And in 2000, Sandy, my dad, was looking for additional companies to acquire, basically. And I was out in Berkeley, and I loved this kind of product, and he felt like it would be a great match. And I just so appreciate the opportunity to have joined the family business and be a part of this incredible growth that we've had at Peaceable Kingdom.
What was happening in your career at that time where it seemed like the right thing to do was to switch gears and run this company?
Yeah, it was exactly the right moment. I had been in film for almost 10 years. My son at the time was about 5. I was ready to go back to work. This was a company of children's products. It felt like such a good match for me on a personal level.
Were you done with what you were doing? Had you taken a break?
I did take a break. And in fact, I wanted to go back to film, and I was able to do job share. It was wonderful. I had this incredible boss who allowed me to sort of job share with another woman who had a child at home. And it worked out pretty well at work, but, you know, it didn't work out great at home. And I didn't like leaving my son and my family, and I wanted to be able to raise my child. So I made the choice to stay home. And that was a profound choice for me. I've always seen myself as a working woman in the world. I love having something to do that stimulates me, that's challenging, where I'm learning all the time. And I felt like child rearing actually was that for me during those years. It gave me time to kind of settle into being a mother, maybe finding myself a little bit. And I was ready to take on the challenge of being in business. I was not a good businesswoman for years. It took a long time for me to really understand what it meant to be in business. But I had great teachers in my brothers and my dad and others in the company.
When you started to run the game business, and you hadn't had a ton of experience in business, what was your first obstacle? What was the first thing that you had to figure out that completely surprised you?
Writing a business plan, I have to say. Here, I'd been in the company for a few years. We were sort of moving along step by step. And it suddenly dawned on me that we probably should have a strategy for where we're going and what we're doing. And at the time, I found out about an organization that helped CEOs. And I joined that organization, and I kind of call it my informal MBA. I was with a facilitator and a group of individuals, all who had businesses in the same size as mine. And I learned from them. I learned a ton about writing a business plan, which I did right away, but how to hire, how to fire, how to set a budget, how to really look at what are the key issues in any business. It doesn't really matter what that business is, and be able to think about finding solutions that work for us.
Donna, you're now in this position where you've got shelves full of cooperative games for kids, and it feels like maybe adults should start playing these games. I mean, you know, adults can play them with their children, but it seems like there's something to be learned from these games that could help us out with where we are right now.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you on that. And I'm sure a lot of people in our country are in agreement on that. I think one of the things that our games try to do is really encourage empathy in people, really looking at the other, you know, standing in the other's shoes. What's that all about to be in that situation? And so to be able to carry it outside the game is pretty important. You know, now it's always really important. I would love to see some adults sit down and play Hoot Owl Hoot or Feed the Woozle or Memory Palace or Friends and Neighbors, any of our games that are out there. It's a simple way to kind of put this under discussion.
Do you think there's a version of the game that could come out that would allow us to talk about the issues in front of us?
Absolutely.
That are so much more adult and frightening.
Maybe that's our charge right now. There are adult cooperative games, actually, and it plays the same way. They're much more strategic, obviously, than our games, but they really ask the players to look at one another. One of the most famous, called Pandemic, is the players are trying to save the world from a pandemic, and they're doing good in the world.
That could come in handy.
Yes.
Tell me about Feeding the Woozle.
Feeding the Woozle. Mm-hmm. So this is a soft win game. We call it a soft win game where players are feeding silly snacks via a plastic spoon into a stand-up Woozle head. And a Woozle is a little monster guy, but the kids find it silly and entertaining. Parents find it silly and entertaining. It's a get-up-and-move game. It's not a sit-down kind of quiet game. It's a funny, laughing, energetic game that helps kids with gross motor skills, with language, with fine motor and counting, with playfulness, pretend play. So there are all ways that really at that age, 2, 3, maybe 4, kids are really looking to have fun, and parents are really looking for them to learn something along the way.
What is the sweet spot age for your games?
It's really preschool. It's 3 to 5.
What's the best advice that you've been given for getting along with someone you don't agree with?
I would have to say it probably came from my grandmother. And there was someone in our family who was a little tricky, I would say, to get along with. And she opened her heart to this woman and to every person, I have to say. So I don't know that she said anything in particular, but it was how she was in the world. It really was how she related to people, what a big open heart she had for everyone, inviting people over, bringing them into the fold, making sure that they felt comfortable when so many people would have left them out. And I think that's one of the most important things I've learned in my life, how to just keep your heart open to everybody.
Wonderful. Well, Donna, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
That was KALW Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller speaking with Donna Jaffe, president of cooperative board game maker Peaceable Kingdom. A federal judge has ruled that 3 transgender students at a Pennsylvania high school can use bathrooms that correspond to their stated gender identities while their lawsuit challenging the school district's policy continues. In issuing a preliminary injunction, the judge said that the students are reasonably likely to win the case on equal protection grounds. 2 students born anatomically male who now identify as female and 1 born anatomically female who identifies as male sued in October. U.S. District Judge Mark Hornack says the Pine Richland School District has not demonstrated its policy advances an important governmental interest, nor is there evidence that personal privacy is being threatened. In February, the Trump administration ended federal protection for transgender students that allowed them to use public school bathrooms and locker rooms matching their gender identities. With threats against Jewish community centers across the country and vandalism at Jewish cemeteries, the name Anne Frank has appeared in the news. For example, the New York City-based Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect advocates for civil and human rights, calling out prejudice and countering discrimination through education programs and grassroots organizing. It alleges President Trump is not responding to a rise in anti-Semitism. And as for the travel ban, the group tweeted, "We look at Muslim refugees and see the Anne Franks of our time." Now Gilles Malkin brings us an encore edition of Women in History, a profile of Anne Frank.
Of all the tales of women at odds, perhaps the most poignant is the story of a girl who was never given the chance to become a woman. Her name was Annelise Marie Frank, better known to us as Anne Frank. Her diary, written while she and her family lived in concealment in Amsterdam during World War II, has become known as one of the most unique and moving testaments to the fortitude and the hope that abides within the human spirit in all of literature, and due to its purity and candor, one of the most remarkable documents ever preserved. Anne was born in 1929 to German Jewish parents. Her father, Otto, was a businessman who worked for his brother in the food products market. He moved his family to Amsterdam in 1933 due to the advent of the Nazis' rise to power. The Franks lived a regular and rewarding life. Anne and her sister made many friends, and the family prospered until 1940, when the Nazis invaded Holland, and the Jewish population found itself under their authority and oppression. Jewish families were isolated from the general population and placed under the imposition of severe restrictions. They couldn't ride bicycles or in cars. They had to wear the yellow star on their clothes. They had to be off the streets and inside their homes from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. They had only 2 hours per day to shop. They couldn't attend theaters or movies or any other shows or events, and were forbidden to participate in any type of athletics. For her 13th birthday, Anne received a diary in which she wrote regularly from 1942 on. It was in July of that year that Otto Frank relocated his family of eight into living quarters called the Secret Annex, which he had prepared for them in a hidden portion of a warehouse, the entrance to which was a bookcase that swung open and was locked from behind. It was in this self-imposed prison that Anne, whose fondest wish was to become a writer, described her life and herself in detail, first in her book and then on many additional sheets of paper, brought to her by friends of the family who were collaborating in their concealment. Now, imagine living in a confined space with no direct contact with the outside, waiting and hoping all day, every day, for the rescue of your country by armies far away, moving around in stealth, lest the workers downstairs hear you, never leaving the building even for a moment, relying upon the help of a few friends to bring food, medicine, and news by means of a secret entry and only in the night, being careful never to be detected at a window, never raising your voice, never going outside to walk on the grass of the earth for fear of being apprehended and deported, or worse. Anne wrote of her guilt for being in hiding while many others were captured and deported in cattle cars, of her crush on another boy in hiding with them, of her objections to her parents, and other normal teenage experiences, these new petals of human flowering in bittersweet contrast to the gloom of her prison. On June 6, 1944, their hope was answered by the D-Day landing on the beaches of Normandy, only 250 miles away. Anne's last entry is dated August 1st, in which she voices her misgivings not for the world, but for realizing her own potential because of her impulse to forever conceal the true feelings in her honest and caring inner self for fear of ridicule in a hostile and unforgiving world. No one's ever been charged as responsible for betraying the family, but on August 4th, their hiding place was raided and the entire family arrested, along with two of their helpers. Anne's papers were scattered. Everyone in the family, including Anne, then 15 years old, died in the concentration camps of the Nazi regime, with the exception of her father, Otto Frank. Anne's diary was preserved and returned to him by one of the Amsterdam helpers who had escaped arrest. The Diary of a Young Girl was published in 1947 and is still considered one of the greatest books of the century. One may try to describe it, but if and when you read it, you'll see that all that may be said about it is that through her writing, through her personal feelings, an understanding of her inner state of innocence and optimism, and her belief in human goodness comes about despite all her doubts and misgivings about herself that can't be described in anyone else's words. written from the darkness of desperation. It should be read by all who wish to be touched by the light of freedom. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1442.